Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The United States in recent years has been regarded not just as a great power, but as the world's sole superpower. How long can it maintain this position? History shows that the path of imperial rise and fall is a well-trod one. Over the past five centuries, a number of nations have risen to build substantial global empires, but each of these nations, in turn, was unable to sustain its dominant position and lost its empire. In today's program, we'll look closely at two earlier empires, that of Spain and Britain. What made them rise? What made them fall? And is the United States destined for the same fate? Please stay tuned for today's edition of History Counts, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to look at the history of great powers. What causes them to rise and fall? And what does the history of earlier great powers tell us about the United States today and in the future? To help us discuss these questions, we're very fortunate to have with us Professor Paul Kennedy. Professor Kennedy teaches history at Yale University, where he's also the Director of International Security Studies, a center for teaching and research in grand strategy and international diplomatic and military affairs. Professor Kennedy is the author of the classic book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, which traces the history of great powers in Europe from the 16th to the 20th centuries. Originally published in 1987, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers became a bestseller and has since been translated into over 20 languages. Professor Kennedy, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
In The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, you observe that a nation becomes a great power through its economy, not its military, and that it tends to decline when it spends too much on the military. Could you please discuss that?
Sure. Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, which, as you say, came out 21 years ago, did look at the relationship between economic change and military conflict and spending over a 500-year period. And it seemed to me that a certain pattern emerged. In all these cases, there may be exceptions or whatever, but here is the pattern. Generally speaking, a country which is rising, and by that we're talking all the time about relative power, relative shares of the pie, a country which is rising is noticed first as an expanding or successful entity because of its faster rate of growth, its adoption of new technologies, its productivity, it's enhanced prosperity. It's got more in its pocket and is producing more. But because we live in and have lived since the beginning of humankind in an anarchic, war-prone world of rivalries and tensions, whether it's between, you know, Germanic tribes or Italian city-states, we can't just measure power by who makes the most bucks. And over time, countries, as well as other folks and other entities that are smaller than countries, tend to want to buy protection, to have some form of military insurance to ensure that their rise continues, to defend themselves against hostile, critical nations. Sometimes, if they're in a more aggressive mode of expansion, they want military power just because they're going to claw their way to the top and take over neighbors or distant transoceanic societies. So there has always been a kind of interesting relationship between economic growth on the one hand and like development of military power and military capabilities on the other.
What does this phrase imperial overstretch mean?
Well, what I've just been describing, Ken, is the rising side, that is to say, what happens when a country is rising first economically and technologically and then deciding to have more of its resources invested in the military and protection and looking after itself and perhaps beating off enemies. That's the rising side. What happens if, however, you start putting more and more of your resources into military expenditures, perhaps for good reasons, because you're being threatened on all sides, but nonetheless, it's a sort of a little bit of a zero-sum game. That is to say, you've got everybody, however rich and powerful, and we will get on to the United States in a little while, everyone has to make choices about priorities. And if you place more and more of your resources onto the military security side of your tally or your budget, there's fewer and fewer resources for investing in your economic and financial future and your prosperity. So the really successful great powers are those who've noticed this and they try to keep as best they can, and it's very hard, as best they can, they try to keep a balance between their financial, economic, commercial productivity and prosperity on the one hand, and their need for security and spending on the insurance policy of armed forces on the other. If you can keep that balance for a very long while, like the British Empire from the 18th century to the Second World War, you've got a kind of self-reinforcing recipe. If you overbalance by just spending on lots of finance and trade and goods, like the Venetians, but you cannot, after a while, meet the larger military challenges of jealous neighbors, you're finished. And if, like Adolf Hitler and the Japanese in the Second World War, you overbalance by putting too many of your eggs into the military basket and are too aggressive, then you've also lost this sense of equilibrium and you come crashing to the ground.
What are the early examples of imperial overstretch that you write about is the Spanish Empire in the 1500s and the 1600s. How important was Spain then?
Through a series of really remarkable diplomatic arranged marriages, Spain acquired through its Habsburg connections a large number of properties in Italy, in the Netherlands, in Burgundy, in part of West Central Europe, very flourishing parts of the world, just at the same time as it was carving out its empire in the far west.
And the Spanish found themselves enmeshed quickly in various wars with rivals like France, the Ottoman Empire, but also with rebellions in some of their possessions like the Netherlands, which drained the empire.
Yes. Now, here's the thing. You can appear to your neighbors as really big, you know, 500-pound gorilla in the monkey cage because you've got not only the unified Spanish peninsula, you've got colonies around Africa, you've got the Philippines after a while, after all, it's named after Philip II of Spain. You've got the silver mines of Potosi, you've got the Mexican-Peruvian trades. You've got your dynastic legacies in Europe, and you look pretty big and imposing. But it's been a kind of almost mechanical or physical rule in international affairs that if somebody looks as if they're getting a bit too big for their boots, then unless they're really smart in persuading the others not to worry about the 500-pound gorilla, the others will start, A, being fearful, and B, trying to think of ways to sort of weaken the 500-pound gorilla.
Even people that don't like each other, you give the example of the French, who are Christians, and the Turks, who are Muslim, joining together their fleets in an attack on Nice against the Spanish Empire.
Yes, and this is a big dilemma for the first of the very well-known Spanish monarchs, Philip II of Spain, who was there on the throne in almost, you know, 40 years of the second half of the 16th century. He is engaged in the transatlantic Latin American conquest and is being attacked by northern European pirates and predators, the Dutch, Francis Drake, and the rest. He has to face a truly large Ottoman threat in the Mediterranean. His rival across the Pyrenees, France, hates Spain and wants to bring it down. the Dutch erupt in a Protestant Reformation in the 1550s, and he finds himself sucked into an 80-year-long type Vietnam War.
And then he has to also fight the English in the sense that they're helping the rebels, do you say?
The English are helping the rebels. It's very hard to get at those frustrating English because you can only get at them by sea. And therefore, you know, the more resources you put in trying to develop sea power, the fewer men and resources and guns and cannon you have for defending yourself in the Mediterranean or for supporting your Habsburg allies in Germany, and so on. So your bigness kind of provokes not a single rival to go at you, but your bigness means that you're trying to be strong in all areas against a really mixed batch of jealous rivals.
So how does Spain pay for all this?
It has terrific sources of revenue, including those from the New World. But increasingly, because those sources from the New World sometimes get attacked, and because just the inflow of silver creates price inflation, it has to turn more and more to taxation.
And you also have to borrow money.
Yes.
So all the money that you're borrowing could have been used to invest in improving your economy. Instead, it's being used to defend your empire from military threats.
And the costs of war just rise and rise and rise. So I once remember reading one economic historian who said that if there's anything I've noticed about the past 1,000 years as a general principle, is that the cost of weapon systems and the cost of war goes up and up and up from one century to the next.
So by the middle 1600s, Spain's vast empire, you say, is pretty much reduced, at least in Europe, to the Iberian Peninsula. Spain is eclipsed, and I'd like to move on to one of the succeeding empires that you talked about earlier, the British Empire, which became dominant in the 19th century particularly. What strengths did Britain have that put it on top amongst the great powers?
Already before the Industrial Revolution, you had both the strategic advantage of being an island state. So you didn't need to have enormous big fortifications and defenses all the way along your borders like the Dutch had, like the French had. You could concentrate more on having a pretty efficient navy.
So it has the navy, it establishes the trade routes, and then as the Industrial Revolution comes along, it's best positioned to exploit it.
There was developed in late 17th century England a set of financial institutions which we take for granted today. It was a national bank, Bank of England, a stock exchange, limited companies, a Congress, or in that case a House of Parliament, which voted an annual budget, the rule of law, the primacy of commercial law, and a passion on behalf of the parliamentarians for balanced budgets.
You say that in the mid-19th century, when the empire was at its zenith, it was maintaining this huge empire covering about a quarter of the world's population on a relatively small military budget. But by 1910, the military spending by Britain had increased substantially. What brought about that change?
You might say just pure imitation and pure envy. The British had found a system based upon sea power, so even the land powers, France, Russia, Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany, in the Far East, Japan, in the Western Hemisphere, the U.S., they all decide they need to have big navies as well.
And their big navies, their military buildups, were accompanying a tremendous rise in their economies, particularly in Germany, correct? You write that coal production in Germany tripled between 1890 and 1914.
Yes, so this gets back to the thing we discussed at the very beginning, the relationship between shifting economic power and shifting military influence. The British, because of a series of inventions and because they controlled trade routes and therefore export markets, when the British moved into the steam power driven revolution, they leapt ahead of everyone else for the first 50 years. But then everybody else said, wow, you know, we have to get those railway lines. We have to get our own steam engine. We have to get our ironclad ships. We have to have our own iron and steel industries, machine tool industries, later on chemical electrical industries. And all of the countries which were then involved in catch-up turned out to have a significantly larger population than the medium-sized population of the United Kingdom in the 19th century. So when you start doing catch-up and you've got a larger potential of training a population to high standards of skill, then the advantage which the original front-runner country had begins to diminish. And when the original front-runner country is being challenged not by one rival, we're not talking here about like the, you know, the Cold War between Washington and Moscow, but when Great Britain is being challenged by, in industrial, technological, productive terms, challenged by United States, Germany, Russia, Japan, then you have a really difficult act to try to pursue.
So you say that Britain spends much more to maintain its empire in the late 19th century and early 20th century, even as its share of industrial production is dropping.
I hadn't thought of it quite like that, but if you think about it, the kings of Spain surely spent a lot more in trying to preserve their empire than they had in gaining the empire to begin with.
Well, ultimately, its competition with others, particularly with the Germans, leads to the two world wars and huge setbacks for the British economy. And you see a vast shift of wealth from Britain to the United States.
Yes, you have rising just across the North Sea, a more populous, highly trained, highly industrialized society with a more aggressive regime of the Kaiser in and before the First World War, and then a truly manic regime of the Third Reich. And in fact, you begin to see you're fighting for survival. Now, this means you have to start pulling back your resources from across the globe. You have to bring your battleships back from the Far East and the Mediterranean. You're fighting for your life. And as you are fighting from 1914 onwards, and from 1939 onwards, your main commercial rival at this stage, the United States, is sitting on the fence as a neutral. And one of the lessons of the wars of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries was it's better not to get in a war too early. Sit on your hands. If you can, sell to both sides. Learn some lessons. Develop your own strengths. Let the two sides kind of exhaust themselves quite a bit, and then move in. With, you know, in September 1940, with 1,800 Luftwaffe planes over London and Kent and Surrey, the British didn't have the luxury of sitting on your hands. You're fighting for your life, and you therefore spend down all of your hundreds of years of accumulated assets. You sell off all of your insurance stock in American insurance industry, which was essentially for many years a British insurance industry. You sell your stock in Latin American companies for dollars, and you pay the price for being pinned down at a time when you have less and less freedom of action of the sort you had normally expected to have for the previous 250 years.
So even though Britain is a victor in the war, it's the United States, its ally, that really reaps the fruits of victory.
Yes, it is. It's a case of you pour out your whole heart, as surely Winston Churchill did, but the end result is that you have exhausted yourself, and there is a successor nation waiting in the wings.
So the U.S. had that luxury, let's say Britain did early on, of spending relatively little on its defense as it expanded enormously economically. But now, after World War II, the United States succeeds Britain as a preeminent great power. Where is the United States today in terms of the trajectory of great powers?
The late departed political science scholar at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, who just died, said, the most interesting thing about the United States and the world and the political landscape of the world in the 20th century is that for the first half of the 20th century, the United States was the line of last defense. It was way to the rear, and it benefited from being to the rear and not up front. What changed that was the collapse of the Axis powers and then what seemed to be a terribly threatening, aggressive Soviet Union leading to the Cold War. And after, you know, the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, the formation of NATO, the alliances we developed with Japan, Australia, for the second half of the 20th century and now through until today, the United States is the front line of defense. And that really shifts your freedom of maneuver.
So we're in a position of defending on many fronts.
Some of our country men get very annoyed when you make some cross-reference to Philip of Spain. It's not meant to be about the personality of Philip of Spain. It's just that that guy had to deal with challenges from five different directions.
So we are spending relatively more on defense, and would this be causing our economy to lose opportunities and to decline relative to others?
Well, you might want to think of the total national economy as something like a pizza pie, in which you can, you know, cut it and slice it into bigger or lesser shares. Generally speaking, most economies, the biggest share of all is consumption. Then there's a slice which is savings, that's for investment in the future. And then there's a slice which is for insurance protection. That means your armed services, your defense budget. On the whole, and because of the Cold War, and because of the, you know, very concerned commitment to maintaining high defense profile, the slice of the pie that the United States devotes to defense spending is higher than any other of the democracies.
And as you've written recently, we've been forced to borrow huge sums of money from foreign creditors in order to maintain our service, our budget, and our trade deficits.
Yes, that's because the slice of the pie which we devote to national savings is incredibly slim. Sometimes it's been even negative.
With respect to these huge borrowings, you wrote recently, quote, "We could be looking at as large a shift in the world's financial balances as that which occurred between the British Empire and the United States between 1941 and 1945. Could you expand on that?
Be careful what you wish for. There's a very, very considerable support for new President Barack Obama's intention to use an awful lot of federally created, congressionally authorized funds to stimulate the economy. Infrastructure, education, buying toxic loans from banks, investing in job creation schemes. And most people nod their head at that and say, wow, you know, the sooner the better. But the fact is that the feds do not just print money, which is all of that will take money, and throw it out the window. They auction the money which is authorized by the Congress through a series of monthly auctions of Treasury bonds. And whereas in the 1930s, coming out of the Great Depression and the New Deal, and especially in the 1940s in the war, it was Americans who dipped into their savings to buy the treasuries in order to produce the surge in American economic growth that won us the war. Right now, it seems, without anybody in Congress actually debating this, the only way in which we can float as loans almost $2 trillion of debt is by asking foreigners to buy the treasury stock.
Well, in view of the examples of the previous empires that are discussed in your book, would it not be prudent for the United States at this point to start to pull back, say as Britain did after World War II, try to reduce its commitments around the world so that it would have more capital available to invest in economic competitiveness?
Pulling back is, and has historically always been, psychologically different. First of all, it suggests you're on a kind of imperial retreat, and actually nobody wants to be the first generation of the imperial retreat, right?
Right.
Secondly, you're not thinking of pulling back everywhere, so there's a debate goes on among your policy elites, and we actually are seeing a interesting example of it, which is saying, let's pull back A so at least we can be a bit stronger in B.
Well, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our discussion.
Yes.
And just one final question. Is there any way out of the dilemma that the great power finds as it declines? If it retreats, on one hand, it loses control, particularly over raw materials and trade. If it continues to wage war, then it drains itself economically.
I think the overall lesson is the one we talked about at the very beginning of our discussion, which is, can you get the balance better? Can you get a better balance between your capacities on the one hand and your many obligations on the other? Right now, it looks as if we are keeping up our many obligations, unless President Obama does get us out of Iraq in the next year. But we need to strive to increase and enhance those capacities, our prospects for increasing prosperity, output, manufacture, and our trying to get away from our reliance upon other countries to pay for our debts. Because after a while, other countries will call in their chips.
Thanks very much for being with us, Professor Kennedy.
All right, Ken. Thank you so much.
You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking with Professor Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. Here are some numbers to give you an idea of the scope, cost, and consequences of the United States' global military commitments. According to the Pentagon's public records, the United States has between 737 and 860 military bases in over 130 foreign countries around the world. Additionally, the United States has been fighting a war in Afghanistan since 2001 and another in Iraq since 2003. The current price tag for annual military-related expenditures is about $1 trillion, roughly equal to the defense spending of all the other countries in the world combined. The federal budget deficit is expected to exceed $1 trillion in the current fiscal year, and the total accumulated debt of the United States government is over $10 trillion. Foreign governments hold about 25% of that debt, and the proportion has steadily grown in recent years. The leading foreign creditors of the United States are China, with about $700 billion in U.S. debt, and Japan, with about $600 billion. How long foreigners will be willing to finance the United States deficit is not clear. However, the United States would find it much more difficult to finance its deficits should foreign central banks move away from the dollar as the world's reserve currency. As a result, the United States may have reached that critical point where its military efforts to maintain its global position could undermine the country's very independence. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org. where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. That's historycounts.org. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.